So welcome to the second session. We continue with the attribute grammars today, and then we'll quickly go on to the symbol tables. So last week I told you about the attribute grammars, how we the notation we use, which is important to write down attribute grammars that can then be evaluated. We've talked about how to determine whether these attribute grammars could create cycles, like have cyclic dependencies between the equations so that it's impossible to evaluate them. So now I'm just going to give some examples of typical implementations, which are often much easier than the generic way of writing down attribute systems. So for instance, if we consider that we often have some sort of state that we want to pass around, we'll usually look at the following situation. For instance, suppose we want to number all the leaves, so the letters of an abstract syntax tree over four regular expressions. Then what we need to do, so in this case we would go down, and this is the computed attribute. So we need to descend and have some sort of counter, and the counter is zero, so we put the annotate the node with zero here, then we go up and we go down again to the other side, and the counter is now one, so we put the counter in here, and then we go up again, and then eventually we'll come down here, the counter is now two, so we put the counter in here, increment it, and so on, then it's three here, and it's four here, and we're done. And what this computation internally has is this counter, which is some sort of, which is a state. So a very typical computation of a state is that it's passed down and then passed up again once the computation is done. So suppose we have two attributes for the state, one is pre and one is post. So the pre attribute holds the state before we visited a child, and the post attribute contains the state after we visited the child. So pre passes the value down, so it's inherited attribute, and post is used to pass the state back up, so it's a synthetic attribute. So for instance, for the root, say R goes to the regular expression, what did we have, E, then we have that the initial value of pre is zero, so at the root, I should probably write it down differently. So if I write it vertically, then we used to write the attributes such that we have pre here and pre here and post, and then we say so pre is set to some value, and then pre of one, so the first child, gets its value from the pre zero, and pre and post of zero, so post at the left-hand side symbol R gets its value from the post of one from the first child. So the dependencies can be written down as I've done with the blue arrows. So inside a node, any node that has two children, like the concatenation or the OR, will pass in the pre-state from above, pass it to the first child, we extract it from the first child through the post, set it to the counter in the second child, and then extract the counter after we visited the second child, and that's the result within that node. So if we have E has something, so if we say, I'll write that on this side, if E goes to some symbol, and an E here, and an E here, then we have a pre here and a post here, and we have a pre here and a post here, pre, post, and so the dependencies are such that the first child gets the pre from the pre in the root, then out comes the post. The post passes its value on to the pre of the second child, And then once the second child is visited, it has set post, and that value then flows flows to the post in the root. So the information flow, so the dependencies are such that post can only be evaluated when the second child has been visited, and the second child can only be visited once the first child has been visited. And before I visit the first child, I have to pass the information from the pre in the root to the pre of the first child. Oh, and at the leaf, the value of the pre field goes to the post field, and we increment it. And basically, we could also have an equation, say the leaf could have a number attribute, and we could set that to pre of 0, for instance. And then maybe later we want to just forget the pre and the post attributes, and we're only interested in the num attribute, which gives you the number of the leaf. Yeah. Yes, that's.
Shouldn't it be the other way around? The pre-value is equal to pre 0.
Because post is single negative, so
the information flow must be wrong.
Well, we've said, if I'm not mistaken, that this is the arrow direction. And this is. Oh, did I do this wrong? Then I drew it wrong. I'm sorry. So it's this way around. Oh dear. Yes. Oh yeah, so it's the information flow, sorry. So this is right? Okay, yeah, so sorry, this is then wrong as well. Sorry about that. Really, it was only a test whether you pay attention. Okay, so yeah, so it depicts the information flow. Although if you do it consistently the other way around, you'll have cycles either way. You just have to be consistent. But yes, for the exam, please use the last lecture's notation. Okay, so here it is. These are the dependencies, and this is hopefully what I've now had on the last slide. It is strongly acyclic, so this is an E. Where's my... Hello? Why does this not work? Okay. Oh, now it works. Okay, so this could be an E, and this is an E, for instance, and this is an E for expression, and this is the terminal, which is also a rule that says E goes to a terminal. And so we can plug this in here, and we can plug this in here, and either with a strong or the weak acyclicity test, we'll find out that this is not cyclic, so we can evaluate it. So in each node, we have an inherited attribute that we have to compute before we visit the child, and this kind of corresponds, if we only had such nodes, it's kind of some sort of pre-order traversal, so during the traversal we compute something before we descend into the children, and we have something, the synthetic attribute, we compute after we return from the child, so it has notions of a post-order traversal as well. So with attributes you can, with the generic attribute systems, you can do all sorts of computations either before or after you visit the children. So in general, it's not a simple, it's not a strict pre-order, post-order traversal. Okay, so but what is special about this attribute system is that all attributes here, which are only two, can be computed during a single depth-first traversal. So it is depth-first. It's neither pre nor post-order, but it's depth-first. So we first, it's not level-wise, but we descend into the children, and then we descend into the next child. And we could also imagine some, like, I mean, there's some tree algorithms that give you the trees at each level in sequence, and that would be a level order traversal. But it's the depth-first traversal, so we just descend. But it, in particular, it goes from left to right. And before we visit the child, the leftmost child, we do some sort of pre-order traversal here, and then we visit the second child, and we do some computation with the second child, and after the last child, we do some computation and pass it back up. So in particular, all the children are evaluated from left to right, and that is quite common way to pass on information, to compute things in an attribute system. And so these equation systems that have this property that all the information flows from left to right are called L-attributed, and that's what I want to define now because they form an important class of attribute grammars. So in attribute systems, L-attributed, if for all productions, so these S's can be terminals or so this is definitely non-terminal, but these could be terminals or non-terminals. Every inherited attribute of one of the right-hand side symbols only depends on right-hand side symbols that have a smaller index, so that if we do an evaluation from left to right, these children have already been visited. So I can use all the information from the children on the left, because I've visited them already. And those, the information from the children that have already visited, I can use to compute the child SJ as inherited attribute, so I can pass that information down. And furthermore, all the synthetic... so the only inherited information I have in a specific node is that from the root node. So I can always use the inherited information from the left-hand side. Okay, so the root node has some inherited information. I can use that in the visit to every child. But for the jth child, I can only use the information, the synthetic information that has come up from visiting the children to my left. And that's an L-attributed. That's the definition of L-attributed, visit from left to right. So the interesting thing about L-attributed equation systems is that they can be evaluated directly during parsing, because you visit the sequence of token is scanned in a left to right way, and the grammar is reduced no matter whether you use an LL or an LR parser. You always construct the leftmost child first. Once you've done that, you reduce your rules, then you've done, before that you try to reduce your substructure of the program, and it always works from left to right. You'll always have your rules reduced in the way that the tree is constructed from left to right, because the input is read from left to right. So for instance, if you don't want to construct a syntax tree, for instance, if we have a simple expression evaluator, like if you write a pocket calculator where you just type in things and it will just say, do reductions, you, instead of building a syntax tree, you could immediately compute the result. Or if you want to emit error messages during parsing, you will actually emit error messages in the sequence in which you read in the input text. So the evaluation strategy for L-attributed grammars is fixed. It's a single depth first traversal, as I've said earlier. And so one idea, if you have a general attribute system, is that you could try to partition all your attributes A into n sets, A1 to AN, such that within each set AI, the attributes in there are L-attributed. And then you can have n depth first traversals to compute all the attributes. And usually, if you sit down and design an attribute system, you probably will think of an L-attribute system first, because you know how to implement the traversal. Okay, so what are the practical applications for L-attributed attribute systems? Well, most things you ever want to do with a syntax tree, like build up symbol tables, do type checking or inference, and code generation, you can do. Basically, you can construct a new syntax tree by doing an L-attributed traversal, and your attribute is just the new syntax tree. Yeah.
But what if the big A
So whenever you have an edge that contradicts the L-attributed definition, you have to make sure. So if you have an edge from B to A and that edge violates the definition of L-attributed, you have to first do a depth-first traversal that computes A, and then later on you have in a second pass, like so that could be A1, and then in a second pass, path in A2, you compute B. Yes, so I mean the idea of the partitioning is that you partition your attributes equations in a way that they become L-attributed. This is not always possible if there's a flow in one direction and then a flow backwards. If you have a flow from, so your partitioning will be in a way that there's no edge from A2 to A1 that violates the L-attribution definition. But it could be that you have an attribute system where the value flows back and forth and where there is a visiting strategy, but you cannot turn that into a partitioning that you can visit in an L-attributed manner because A could flow to B and later could flow back to A and so on. So in general, this is not possible. Okay, other applications, well, if you want to annotate stuff in your syntax tree, usually with additional information, that usually is all possible and done with an L-attributed equation system. Okay, there's a lot of text which is true, but it's not necessarily in context. I think this is the reason for this text is that this might, it talks about types, so if you have a set of attributes, you could probably partition them into different attributes there because into different kind of information you're computing. So you've seen pre and post in the example, they were used to number the leaves. They're two attributes, but they're kind of working together. And so in general, you could think of, well, how can I semantically partition my attributes? So, and then I can probably put these attributes into one L-attributed system, but for which I can do a depth-first traversal. Okay, so last slide. This is an example how to visit the evaluation of an attribute. Of visiting an AST in Java, which is called the visitor pattern. So normally in a functional language where you have pattern matching, you would define your AST as this collection of algebraic data types with different constructors. We could also say variadic records, where you have tags identifying different variants of a record, which is the same thing, really. So Turbo Pascal had that, but like in Haskell and SML, you'd have algebraic data types, which is one constructor giving you different version of that data value. But in Java and C and C++, you don't have these algebraic data types. What you have are classes, and with those you can simulate variants of the same type, namely by having one base class, and you derive the special variants as a child class. So, for instance, the regular expressions, the non-terminal regex, might have different production rules. Oh, I'm at the end, right? I can't write there. So it might have different production rules. So it has E. Well, that yeah, okay. Let's call this E. So E might go to E or E. E or E, or it might go to E dot E, or it might be a leaf A, and so on. So you'd have different variations, like either an or concatenation or a leaf. So all these are regular expressions, and you need to, in order to represent these a node of type E, you have three variants. So what you do in Java, you define one class regex that stands for any of these, and then you have special down here you have special subclasses. So for instance, the OR expression extends the reg expression, so that would represent this the E or E, and then you define the children, like the other E values here as member. And now the question is how do you traverse the syntax tree in a generic matter? How can you define an L-attributed traversal without having to re-implement the depth-first traversal all the time? And then there is a trick that people have developed called the visitor pattern, and it works as follows. So you have your base class reg expression. You derive for each grammar rule, you derive one child class. So here you have the OR expression, which extends reg expression, so it's a child. It has this an attribute for each non-terminal, which in turn is will be the base class of the class representing the left-hand side symbol. And now the question is, how do you traverse it? Well, you have in the base class a single method called accept that takes a class called a visitor, and this visitor is only is kind of like a helper construction to make a distinction. The visitor is basically the code that evaluates your semantic equations. So your visitor might have the attributes that you want to compute. Or it might have helper attributes. You have some sort of state you can store in the visitor. I mean, the attributes themselves, they need to be here in the individual nodes because you have to set them. Okay, so how does this work? Well, the visitor class has a different visit method for each of the different child classes. So you have one for dot. Oh, sorry, this should be Rx, right? Because it's a regular expression, one for bar, one for the token of, well, let's say letter or something. And the idea is that what you do is the problem is, how do you call this visitor? So you derive from the visitor class, and you override each method. So you override the OR expression method to say what should happen when I'm visiting the OR expression. So this thing here. The question is, who does call these different methods? And that's where this accept method comes in. So this accept method, all it does, it takes the visitor and calls this specific method. So down here, we override the accept class, and we just say v, the visitor, dot visit, and we pass this. And because the compiler knows that this, in this case, is an OR expression, it will actually call the visit that is with a parameter OR expression. And similarly, if I have a different child class bar, and I have an accept method, and I say v.visit this, then the compiler knows that this is a bar class, and it will call this visit method. And in here, I take the regular expression that I'm being passed and say it has a child. So RE is an RX. So I say RE dot L, which is itself a reg expression. So I can say accept V, which means I'm first visiting the left child, and then I say RE dot L dot accept V, and then I'm visiting the right side, right child. So I have this visitor that always does an L-attributed traversal, a depth-first traversal of the whole syntax tree, and I can override, like I can inherit from the visitor, implement the different methods, one for opx, one for bar, one for letter, to get the functionality that computes the actual attributes. So now I think we should probably do that in the exercise, just to like actually implement this once. Okay, and now I'm getting to symbol tables. I will quickly change slides. Okay, so I've chopped up the slides into several packages, and I'll put them individually on the web page, so that the and so the page numbers are now always relative to there. They're all relative to the beginning of each lecture, more or less, except that I overran the last lecture. Okay, so now, are there any more questions about attributes? About the last, yeah?
I think the recording is still stopped.
No, it is running. Otherwise, it should have a red dot there. So I didn't stop it. Okay. The attribute systems, we've done a lot of with cyclicity and L-attributed now, and I will show you how L-attributed systems can be defined just for symbol tables, for instance. And I won't write down many equation systems, but I'll just tell you how the general idea is. So the problem, what problem do symbol tables solve? So a symbol table is the first thing we need to build when we analyze a program. So we do have a syntax tree, and it has the whole structure of the program that we care about, but we still have no idea what the program should do. And for instance, one complication is that we have variable names and we don't know what the variables refer to, and we need to resolve that. So for instance, this is the function foo. This is, it's kind of C code. It's not really the Java code. It's C, say, C99 plus code, so because we have local functions that doesn't normally exist, but otherwise it's boring. So suppose we have an integer called a that's declared in foo, and then we have a local function bar that declares a double a. Then we say this outer a, the int of type int, is shadowed by a local definition. And you might think, well, C doesn't really have local functions, local definitions. But if you have a global variable a and you have then declare inside a function a variable a, then this local declaration does shadow the global name. So there is some shadowing going on, even in C. And there's much more, shadowing going on in Java, where you can have nested classes. Okay, so so once you have a declaration, the compiler, for each declared variable, the compiler needs to set aside some memory. So the point of a declaration is to tell the compiler, this here is a name that needs some memory, and you need to reserve it. Because if we translate a statement that, say, assigns something to a variable v, we need to know at which address v is allocated, so we know where to write to later on. So, the symbol tables can only deal with kind of static allocation of variables. So dynamic allocation on the heap never creates a name because it doesn't. It just gives you back a pointer, and then you store that pointer into a variable that is statically declared. So all that symbol tables can do is resolve names for statically allocated memory. Okay, and whenever a variable that is declared has a memory allocated at the current program point, we say that it is in scope. And there's a subtle difference between being in scope and the second notion, which is being visible. So for instance, the scope of int A is this whole block. So the memory... So even when I'm calling bar here and bar is running and I'm kind of at a program point in here, then int A is still in scope. It is still allocated while bar is running. However, it's not visible. So if I try to access the outer A, I can't. Maybe in C++, sometimes they have this name resolution operator, and depending on where you are, you can access something that is in a different namespace or like just in the global namespace. So maybe you can say something like this in C++ to just get to the auto identifier. So different languages have different rules here. Okay, so that's the scope. And the scope of double A is just here inside the bar function. And this might seem a bit artificial, but in modern C, like if you have an if-then-else statement, you can in the then statement you can also declare variables, and then it's even more natural to have variables that are in scope but you can't access because they're not visible. So here's an example of how things can become a bit more complicated. So this is now Java, and in Java you can declare functions with parentheses and variables called members of a class, and these can have different attributes as no attribute, protected, private, public, and they all have slightly different semantics. And the semantics, the visibility, so this is all about visibility, because whether a variable is in scope is a question of it's you don't declare that, so you only declare something about visibility. So this goes about visibility rules, which means if you look up this A here, the question is, well, what does this A refer to? Can anybody tell me what this A is referring to? Yeah, it's a function argument. Very simple. It just refers to this function argument. Now, what happens if I replace... Oh, so what does this X refer to? So this refers to the X in foo. And to see that this is legal, we can check... I should draw it the other way around. So if the compiler wants to know where to access the memory to get the value of X, it will have to look at this declaration. It will because here this declaration will have the address later on in the syntax tree where X lives. Okay, so X has no modifier, so it is visible inside the current class, but we're not in the current class. We are in a subclass, so we can access it. Oh. Oh yeah, maybe this should. Package subclass. Yeah, that's weird. Is that correct? I thought I tried this, but maybe I haven't tried this. Does it say? No, it doesn't. Okay, maybe this is... I'll check this until next week, whether this is wrong. Sorry. So this might be the other way around.
From the Java docs, if a class has no modifier, the default was known as package private, it is visible only within its own package. Packages are named groups of related classes. So this means that the subclass...
Well, this is within the same package, that's why.
Yeah, it should be. Well, you didn't define any package, so...
But the line number suggests that it lives in the same package, because it's in the same file.
Yeah.
So it's not wrong. Yeah, it is not wrong, but it's, the reasoning is obviously it's not because it's a subclass, it's because it's in the same package. So all I should do is say, well, why is X visible? It's because it's in the same package, not because it's a subclass. There we go. Okay, problem solved. So I think what I really wanted to ask is something like this. Well, what happens if I put a Z in here? Well, it did say just like, unfortunately. So it doesn't compile because Z is private. If I put in a... what else could I put in? A Y... then it does compile because it is protected, so I can, in a subclass, I can access a protected identifier, and also because it's in the same package. So it's just the private one that doesn't work. So the thing is that the rules for whether an identifier is visible and where its definition comes from are not necessarily trivial, but there is one thing in Java and in all the languages, if you have an identifier, you have to statically know where, you have to be able to statically figure out which declaration you're using. In some other languages, in a few languages that use dynamic binding, you have actually identifiers at runtime. So in Scheme, for instance, you will walk up the stack until you find an identifier that has the same name, and you will use that value, and you'll have a very different type or value, whatever, depending on the calling context where you call your function from, Scheme or and Lisp, at least. In Scheme, it's a bit more sane. Lisp is quite weird there. So here it is. So bar does not compile if it is not in the same package as foo. Oh, and there's this method b here, which has kind of a different name, because what Java stores as the method name is the name that is the declared name of the method plus the arguments. So b with no argument is different to b with the argument int. So I think you've all done that. And it's called static overloading. Static overloading, because it is, everything is decided at compile time, what method is called. Okay, so this is all that the symbol table has to resolve. So this is quite different to dynamic resolution of function calls. So if functions are the same according to the rules that the symbol table can impose, so no arguments and return value. So here I have a subclass of foo called bar, and it has a test method, and here, depending on this flag I'm getting, I will create a foo or a bar object, and then I run foo on that object. So which method is going to be called? If I put in false, will I get one or will I get two? Two. So if I get false, I create a bar object, and x.foo will invoke the method in the bar object, which is this one. So even though it's declared to be a foo, at runtime something else will be called. So this has, but this signature here will determine that I'm going to call one of these here. Okay, so this dynamic resolution, this is beyond the symbol table, so we'll only do the static resolution. Okay, so this has nothing to do with name resolution. Okay, so what do we do? So each identifier eventually has to be turned into some sort of memory area, memory address. And while we're getting the program text in, we'll have lots of identifiers, and we have to kind of find the declaration quickly, because we have a lot of uses and a lot of declarations. Each time we have a new identifier, we need to know, where is the declared version, the declaration of this identifier. And so there are two ideas to make this fast. So the first thing we'll do is replace every identifier by some sort of a unique name. This is basically to avoid handling strings, because strings can be arbitrary long and are complex to compare. So what we do is we turn strings into integers, and then we can compare these integers with normal comparison operators, which is much faster than comparing strings. And also, if we represent, I might not be so important nowadays, but if we would actually store the string of every identifier that we pass in our syntax tree, then we'll store a lot of text, and then storing an integer is just cheaper, because we only need this, integer uses less storage. Okay, so and the second thing we need to do, so we replace every identifier with a unique integer. The second thing, the real symbol table task, is to link each usage of an identifier, so somewhere where I'm using the identifier, to the declaration side where the variable is declared, or finding out that the variable hasn't been declared, which is then an error in Java and C. So we can have different data structures to handle the declared variables and also the visibility of variables, which is important. And some languages like Lisp, Scheme, Python, Ruby, that you don't declare identifiers, you just use them, and then you have to create a symbol table on the fly every the first time you use them. You do declare variables in Python, I guess. No, not at all.
You can,
right? Okay, but you don't have to. Okay, so and then you have this. Two choices. It might be there already, then you have to use it because it has been declared. If the declaration hasn't been done yet, you have to insert a declaration. Okay, so you create variables on the first encounter, declarations for them. Okay, so there's two very separate tasks, and please be clear about these. One is the replacing strings by integers. The second is resolving the variables, linking the usages to the declarations. So I'm going to talk about the first thing. So how can we replace strings with unique numbers? Well, we get a sequence of strings each time we see an identifier. It's kind of the sequence of the identifiers we see in the AST during parsing. Actually, it's done in the scanner usually. Then we output and we allocate a new number if we haven't seen this identifier yet, and then we output the sequence of numbers instead. So the scanner will look at the different bits of strings, and when it sees an identifier, it calls our algorithm. And if we have a number allocated for that identifier, we'll return it, otherwise we allocate a new number. So what we get in is a sequence of strings, and we output the sequence of numbers, one for each input. And so what we need internally is a table that allows us to map the string that we're getting to a number. And so we use that algorithm within the scanner. So as an example, so if we just ignore that we have any other terminals in our input string, if we just had identifiers, we could have a string like this, and then we create unique numbers each time we see a new identifier. So we can just do that. I'll give this identifier the number 0. Can we, what's the next number? Can we, go through the right? 1, very good. What's the next number? 2. What's the next number? 3, very good. It gets harder as we go along. What's the next number? 4. Okay. 5. Where are we here? 6.
7.
Okay. 8. Yay. Something different. What's the next number? 1. 2. Good, thank you. Yeah, it's a bit boring, but 4. Somebody shout if it's wrong. We probably have to go down there, right? 6. Yes. Okay, I think you're getting the gist. 9, something new. The. Yeah, probably. Four, okay. 5, down there.
6.
Can I do the rest? 7, 1. No, 0. Oh gosh, I'm a bat. I'm not a scanner. 2, okay. Looks okay. So this is the output, very simple, and this is all. This is the table. This is like one table that we computed. So each time we have a new identifier, we enhance the table. Is this clear? I think it is clear. Yes.
I think the output's correct.
I hope it is correct. It is not.
And you're missing the 0 after 8.
After 8 here. I don't even know where that is in the input.
I think it was 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and then 0 again.
A 0 missing. I will correct this, of course. Okay, but you can do this, I'm sure. So there we go. So we have a partial map from strings to ints And we use a counter that tells us the last number we haven't assigned yet. And this is the pseudocode. Each time we see a string, we call getIndex and replace that string by the index, so the identifier nodes just have an integer in them. So we just check if we look up the string in the table and it hasn't been defined yet, then we add the new mapping and we increment the counter and we return that mapping for the string. Okay? So what kind of data... So now we can do... now we're getting to the symbol tables, but first of all we have to store this table, this data structure in some sort of table. So here I'm suggesting list of pairs. So we have a linked list of string integer tuples, and the insertion or addition of a new entry is O of 1. And the lookup, on average, we need to like go through half the list, so it's O of n, and it's a bit too expensive. Are there other things? What other data structures could I use?
I would use a hash table to insert the strings and an array to get the string.
Well, but if you have a hash table, you can... Well, all you need to do is you have to ask, well, what number does this string map to? So a hash table should be enough, a hash map. Yeah, for debugging it might be useful. Well, and maybe for code generation, but like that's also debug information, then you might want to refer back to the original identifiers. Okay, well, so here I propose balanced trees, log n insertion, log n access, and then we have hash tables, and that looks all jolly and excellent, and so let's assume that hash tables are the glorious data structure we should definitely use here. And indeed, for this translation, a hash table is certainly a good choice. But now we come to the symbol table, and we see what the complications we will have there. Okay, so the handling of these scoping rules. So now we're entering the symbol table territory, where we look up the declaration. Then sometimes the hash table is not so useful. There are various possibilities. Okay, so how can we implement hash tables? We need a hashing function for strings. So if we have a hash table is an array of size, an array m of size m, and our hashing function needs to map the string to 0 to m minus 1 so that we can access all legal indices. And it has to be cheap, and it has to distribute the identifiers, the words, equally over this range. And so one of the simplest versions is to take the first letter and the last letter of a word. So a word x contains letters x0 to xr minus 1. So r is at least 0 for a one character. Sorry, 1 for one character identifiers. So why the last one? Because many identifiers end in a number, sadly enough, apparently. Many programmers use numbers at the end or make various identifiers that are very similar but chain are different in the last letter. Like in Haskell, you often add a prime, a tick, to an identifier if you have a different, slightly different version of the same value. Another operation is to use some sort of prime number p, and you raise it to the ith power depending on the position where you are, and then you multiply it. And this is, and then you do mod every time, and you can do it perhaps slightly cheaper by using only one mod, by just multiplying this term out and do the modulus at the very end only once. And the classic implementation for hash maps is to store a linked list in each so-called bucket. So you have m buckets, and you store a linked list inside the array at that entry. And then you still have to go through this linked list to find the actual value. So this is an example. So with the zero, first letter and last letter, apparently we get this. I think I've done this on ASCII representation. So you see at least here you have the first letter and the last letter, and they somehow map to the same bucket. Genau, same as Piper and Peters start and end with the same letters, so they should wind up, and it must wind up in the same bucket by this hash function. So still, you need to like compare the whole string, obviously, once you found the right bucket. But in general, this is a reasonable data structure. I think because A plus A is the same value as capital P plus R. Yeah. I think so. I think I've done this programmatically. Otherwise, I mean, I haven't done this on paper. I hope not. You could try. I hope this is correct. Okay. So, symbol tables. So we've done the mapping from strings to integers. And now we're getting to the part of actually resolving, that is, mapping a usage to a declaration. So what we do is we traverse the syntax tree in a suitable sequence, and the suitable sequence will follow the visibility of an identifier. So if we have a local basic block inside an if statement, say the then branch of an if statement, then we go in there, inside there we have a different visibility. If we declare something inside the then branch of an if statement, it will shadow declarations that are on the outside. And so we need to like follow the visibility structure that we want to implement. And in particular, in order to get this right, to determine whether this usage has been declared before, we definitely have to first visit the declarations to add them to our symbol table before we actually check all the usages, which is all L attributed, because usually in the program you first declare your identifiers and then you write a code that uses the identifiers. Okay, so what we can do if we have nested if we allow nested declarations of identifiers, we only have these visibility issues, then we can use a stack of scopes. So each time we enter a new visibility region, we push something on the stack. So if we visit a new declaration, we push it onto the stack, and if we leave that scope, that visibility scope, we remove it from the stack. And then if we have a usage of an identifier, we pick the topmost declaration from the stack, because that is the one that's currently visible. And if we try to pick something off, like if we try to find the last declaration of an identifier on the stack and the stack is empty, that means this identifier has never been declared, and this is an error. Okay, let's look at an example. Okay, so suppose that these V and W are now unique names that I'm trying to assign these variables. So we can think of V and W and X and Y and Z as memory locations. So let's say VW, X, Y, Z are memory locations. But really, they're just nodes somewhere, like, a data structure that describes the declaration. So they're different declarations. So later on, when we emit code, we'll have a different memory address for each of these variables. So what we do is we have this hash table initially at this point in the program, and there's nothing on these stacks here. So I'm assuming that I have that I'm mapping A to an entry 0 because it was the first identifier I saw. B is mapped to 1 because it is the second identifier I saw, and C is mapped to 2 because it is the third identifier I saw. Okay. So I'm having this hash table that happens to have three entries, and in here I'm putting down, no, this is, sorry, this should be an array, well, like one for each identifier. So for each identifier that I could possibly have in the program, I'm having a stack here of the declaration side. So if I if I pass this declaration here, then I will get a symbol table that has V, uses V, the declaration side V for A, and it uses W for the declaration side B. So when I get to the assignment B is equal to 5, I'm going to look up the stack for B, and I'll extract the topmost element, which is W, and that is this declaration, so I know that this declaration belongs to W. Now I'm entering the if statement, and I'm looking up B, so I'm looking up the topmost element, and it's W, so I know that this B also refers to W. Okay, now I'm at this point. So what kind of how does the symbol table now look once I have passed these declarations?
A takes another X.
Okay. And B?
B would have been the same.
B is the same.
Y.
Yeah. So we push these declaration sides X, so information about the declaration called X, onto the A stack, and the declaration information Y onto the C stack, and now we do the lookup. So we look up A, which declaration side do we get?
X.
X, because the topmost symbol is X, so this refers to this declaration side here. Let's take a different color. X. The C, which declaration side? So that goes to Y. And this A here? Still X. And the C here? It's Y, because we look it up here. And the B, we look up the stack for B, and it's W. So it's up here. Okay, so I think you see the principle, I hope. Now, what happens when we return here, like we exit this local then branch? Okay, how would I implement that? Yeah, true. So I could simply retake this table here and use that for the else branch. So I can. So if I look at the syntax tree, I have an if statement here, and I have the then branch, I have the else branch, I have some attribute here that is the symbol table. I could pass it down here, and I could pass the attribute down here. This is a very neat way of doing that because it's very simple. This is not what I'm going to do on this slide, but I'll do in a second. What is the difficulty here if you think of hash tables? Yeah, so he said you would have to copy the hash table. The problem is hash tables are naturally like destructive. So if you say insert afterwards, you have changed the hash table. So if you pass this hash table down here, you cannot you will not, like, once you're done with this child, you don't have the same hash table anymore because it has been modified. So what is the possibility, what is the possible solution here? If I want to do everything destructively, if I want to update this hash table to so that I can get this hash table back. Yes, you could do that. Okay. Well, that's a bit more complicated than it has to be because, like, you could just have one attribute that tells you which variables are declared, and when you're done with a child, you look at these attributes, which are A, C, and for each child, you just say pop. So let's do that. Let's say pop. Okay. So I say pop for A, which leaves me V, and I say pop for C, which leaves me with the empty stack. So I'm back with the original hash table. Okay, so once I leave the then branch, I assume that I've computed all the variables that are added in that, are declared in that then branch, and those variables I call pop for on the hash tables. So this goes away, and this goes away, the A and the C, because these have been declared here. So I'm back with the original table. So I continue. Down here, I enter the else branch with this original table. And what do I get now? So we do have the original table VW, and now what am I getting? There's a Z being pushed onto the C. Okay, and now I'm going to look up. Do I have blue? I want blue. I'm going to look up A, and it gets me where? I don't get that acoustically.
Isn't the third table from counting from top the one which is meant?
Oh yeah, but I don't care. So this is the one that I'm getting while I'm here. I don't care. I don't need that many hash tables. So after the declaration, I get this hash table. So I'm looking up the A, and where's the A? It's the V, so it's getting a bit messy here. And the C is the Z, and so this C is also Z, and this B is the W. Okay, so this is getting messy. And so finally, I'll do the same trick again. I pop all the declared variables here, which is just C, and I'm getting back the original table. So up down here, I have this table again. And I look up A and B, and I get it. I get V and W. Okay? This is the solution, apparently, which means that... So... this symbol table belongs down here, and of course this symbol table belongs here, and this symbol table belongs here. And there's this neck that the alignment is not quite right, and the fact that I'm pushing to the left, not to the right. So please note. Yeah, so here X shadows V. Okay, so, and we can do the same thing in the abstract syntax tree. So one possibility to actually avoid building big tables, like I've done, I had this array with 0, 1, 2, mapping A to some stack. What we can do is we can directly, in each declaration node, we can have the stack we're passing the symbol table around as a state. But what we want to do during compilation, we need to have a link. We have to insert a link to the declaration node. So what we can do is we can, instead of V, W, and Z, what we can do is we can just like track a pointer to the declaration node. So for instance, here in this program, I have int A, B, which means I have the basic block starting with the declaration and continuing with the basic block starting, or like basic block statement. Another declaration, then I have the first thing I have in the basic block is an assignment. Here's an assignment node. So I've replaced A with 0, B with 1, and C with 3. So here I'm declaring the identifier A because it's 0. Here I'm declaring B, and here I'm saying that B is equal to 5. Down here I have B is compared to be greater then 3, which is the branch of the if statement. Then we have the then branch and the else branch, each starting with declarations. Here it is A, and 2 is C, which reflects this one. And so what we do, say if we're down here, and we have 1 is equal to 2, which assignment is that? Yeah, so this is B. B is 1. Is equal to C, so that is this assignment here. And what we can do inside this identifier node, the usage node, we can just set a pointer that goes to the declaration node, so we can just add a pointer right to the declaration node. And here, the C is declared here, so we can add a pointer to this declaration node. And then we store all the information we ever wanted in the declaration node, like the memory address where the variable lives, and each usage has just a pointer to the declaration node. And so we can quickly go, when we say generate code, we see the usage, we follow the pointer to the declaration node, and we see where, where it lives in memory. So we can emit code that writes directly to that memory address. So that's one way of implementing the symbol table without using a table. So really, you only pass down this table of stacks, and afterwards you're done with the table of stacks. You just have a syntax tree that has actually new edges that you could use to visit, but it's probably not a good idea. Like, you do visit them, kind of. Okay, so this is how GCC does it. They store pointers to declaration nodes in their abstract syntax tree. Any questions about this? Yeah, so there were more arrows, which is what I've just done. Okay, so there's alternatives, as you've just said. This resolution pass can be done with an L-attributed grammar. You pass down your state with a table with the stacks, mapping identifiers to stacks through as a state, and you can do that left to right with an L-attributed grammar. And in this case, we have to add and remove you add an element to the stack of each identifier, but there you can do it slightly differently. So if you don't want to have a destructive data structure, say if you write in a pure, in a functional language, there's other ways. So for instance, you could use a list, and you could just push elements onto, or add elements on top of the list. So in the example, we first declared A and B that were visible in the whole body. So we have a list of A and B, and then we have the if statement, and in the then branch, we push A and C on top of this list, or we add A and C on top of the list, and we just remember how many elements we've pushed, and then we pop that many elements when we're done, and then we push the C onto the list. So how does the lookup now work if we just use the list idea instead of a hash table? So in principle, you could say instead of having separate hash tables, we just with linked lists, we just use one linked list or one list or stack to deal with all the identifiers.
Yeah, we have a second stack, and then when we do the lookup, we just pop the top of the stack to the second stack, and when we have found the element, we have the address and we reverse that.
Okay, but like, I mean, If we do the lookup in the list, we need to go through the list anyway, so we don't know whether. Okay, so the lookup, basically, what we've done for earlier, we had the stack and we went through the stack, it was kind of a list, until we found. No, rubbish, what am I saying? Okay, so the idea here, sorry, is that we go down this list and check when we found the identifier. So if we look up an A, you see the A here. If you're in the then branch, you look up an A, you find this A, and you don't find this A because it's shadowed. So you can use a single list, and you just add to the list when you enter a scope, and you pop that many elements when you leave the scope, and then you add the elements when you enter the next scope. So it's like one big list instead, or one big stack instead of several stacks, and then you just have to go down the stack until you find the identifier. Okay? This is like an alternative. And instead of lists of symbols, here we can do a list of hash tables. So we could just say we have a stack of hash tables so that each of these colored regions is one hash table. So this is a hash table. And then we check in each hash table, is the identifier here? If it's not, we check in the hash table below. So this is very efficient if you have shallow programs, so if you don't have a lot of visibility issues. For instance, in C, you have global variables and you have variables, the automatic variables that are declared inside the function, so in old C. You don't have anything, any nesting. You're not allowed to declare variables inside the then branch. And what you can then do is you implement the whole compiler with two hash tables, one for global variables, one for local variables. Whenever you have a variable in your function, you first look in the local hash table variable table, and if it's not in there, you look in the global variable table. Okay, if you have nested scopes, then you can use an idea that you just said, like where you have in general, that would be a persistent data structure. So you have a data structure that, like in Haskell, you have trees that you cannot modify. All you can do is you insert a new symbol, and what you get back is a new tree, and the old tree lives on. And what you can then do, you can have this trick that if you have this if node and you have its two children and you take the tree in here, you just pass the tree to the then branch and you pass the tree to the else branch. And even though inside the then and the else branch you might add elements to this tree, it will not change this tree up here, so you can have this, pass the same tree in there, and you know that it's not going to be modified, or at least not visibly. So this is described down here. So it can be passed down to the basic block where the new elements are added, but since it's all local, it's not visible on the outside or in this attribute. So it's like a pure value. Okay, so there is a table which contains tags of declaration sites. That's one way to resolve symbols, probably the most sensible one if you have many nested scopes. There is a possibility to pass down a list where you just add elements to the list and you descend into the list until you find the identifier you're looking for, and then you can have your popping chunks of that list off when you leave a scope, or you can have persistent trees if you're in a functional language, then that is probably the most elegant solution. Okay, so then we already briefly talked about forward declarations. So if you have recursive data types, recursive functions, either the language requires you to do a forward declaration. That's usually the case, so let's call them old-fashioned languages, or maybe you just like gather up identifiers and then resolve them, check that every declaration that you've inserted in an ad hoc way when you saw in a usage, you later have to check these insertions into the symbol table that there actually also was a declaration. So here are some examples for the old-fashioned languages. So here I'm declaring in C a list that is alternating between ints and double. So the list 0 points to list 1 structure, and the list 1 structure points to list 0. And in order to be able to say in the list 0 declaration that it points to list 1, I need to first add a forward declaration that the struct name called list 1 exists, which will put the entry into the symbol table saying, oh yeah, this identifier exists, but it hasn't been defined yet. And eventually you have to check that all the identifiers in your table are in fact defined. So that's the forward declaration. Alternatively, you do that automatically at the symbols on the fly when you see them. Okay, same thing for recursive functions. So by default, whenever you process the symbols inside a function, you have to add the name of the function to the symbol table, because inside that function you can call the function itself again. And similarly, for mutually recursive functions, you have to do something, either some forward declaration, or you have to, in many languages, explicitly, have some forward, or like some special use some special constructs. So in ML, for instance, you normally declare functions using fun, and then you have these pattern rules. So here I'm declaring the odd function, it calls an even function, and then instead of fun, you have to say and to say this is the same binding group, so it's called a binding group that binds several functions at once. Because here I'm using the name even that hasn't been declared yet, that hasn't been defined, so I have to say and then it will just look at also at this declaration. So odd calls even, and down here even calls odd again. The corresponding C implementation looks like this. I have to declare even in a forward declaration. Well, actually, it's not quite symmetric. then I first declare odd which calls even, and then afterwards I declare even that calls odd. Okay, so these are the things you have to deal with, forward declarations. And in fact, since you have to check later on that once you had this forward declaration that it's actually defined, you might as well, I mean, it's no more hassle to allow to do the automatic way where you insert some identifiers on the fly and later check that they have been actually declared. Any questions about this recursion stuff or the forward declarations? Okay. Right, so there are also overloadings of names. So we've seen that in the Java way where the methods can have different parameters. So for instance, if you have in Java, you have this inheritance, and then if you declare a method and you want to know whether this is correctly declared, then sometimes, or like if you have a message call, a method call, and you're inside some sort of inside a child class, you see a method call and it's called on the actual current instance, you need to find out what the parents are and if the parents define that method. If you don't see it locally, it might be in the parents still. So there you have to like walk up the class hierarchy to find all the available identifiers. So it can be quite like organizing symbols there can be quite challenging. So in Java you also have this method overloading where you have to consider the method parameters to augment the identifier of the method itself. Okay, so and obviously there's also type checking, which I'll talk about next time. But there's some things that make some resolving symbols a bit tricky, and those are multiple classes of identifiers. So if we talk about types, for instance, there are type names in C and there are normal identifiers in C. And also in Java, you have classes, methods, and fields, and they all have that separate namespace. So classes, you can define a class of name foo, you can have a method of name foo, and you can have a member variable or field of name foo, and they don't clash in any way. So you have different symbol tables for these. And moreover, C distinguishes names for variables and names for types. And in fact, that is a very interesting thing, because in C, a name, they share the same symbol table, or they could share the same symbol table, and then you can have declarations that changes the class of an identifier. So for instance, the type def keyword in C changes a name that would be recognized as a variable to a type. And if you look at the C grammar, they actually syntactically distinguish types from identifiers. So the scanner has to return the token identifier if it sees letters that are in the identifier class but that have not been declared as a type. But if that identifier has been declared as a type, it has to return a type token, type name token. So that so a sequence of letters can change the token class in C, if you so will, depending on the declarations we have seen. So the scanner generates a different token based on the class that this an identifier falls, type or normal variable. And then once the parser sees a typedef declaration, this set of type names changes. So as soon as the parser sees a new declaration, it will have to tell the scanner that there's now a new identifier that has to be put into the type for which it has to generate a type token. So it's not entirely context-free anymore, because whatever the parser generates now depends on what the whatever the scanner generates now depends on what the parser has seen so far. Context-sensitive. Yeah. Might not be the right way to name that. Okay, so this interaction is a bit problematic, and I'll try to give an example. So one example is Haskell. It has a similar feature. It has declarations that that declares the precedence of operators. So operators can be created by concatenating any of these symbols. So for instance, this exponentiation, multiplication, division, but you can also have this one, which is like used for monads. So you have all sorts of operators, and they have different precedence, priorities when during parsing, and they have left or right associativity or no associativity, meaning that you cannot use them at all in a nested way. So you cannot say 4 equals 5 equals true, because the compiler will not accept that, even though there might be a correct interpretation, namely like this. Okay, and the grammar of Haskell expressions looks like this. It has like 9 stages of different precedences. This is the lowest, this is the highest. And when the parser sees a plus, it will return a token op, 6, L op 6. So, for instance, so whenever the parser sees a declaration like this, it augments the table for operators, and then the scanner, when it sees then the minus, it will look up in this table to see that it should return an L op 6 token for that, with the minus as a payload. And so on, multiplication is precedence 7, and left associative, and so on, like the declarations say. And that leads to the right, correct parsing of this expression, even though you can declare all your operators. So this is a bit weird. So the scanner changes, has a state, and the state is determined by the parser. So the parser is no longer context-free in the sense that it produces information that changes. Well, if you try to express what the parser does, then it depends on the table. Oh, yeah, maybe that's a bad way to put it. If the scanner is no longer, well, has an additional input, it's not state free, so let's say it like this. So a single code fragment will lead to different syntax trees, and the syntactic correctness then depends on maybe the sequence of modules that are imported. Actually, in Haskell, it depends on the modules that you've imported. If you import different modules, if you import an additional module that has an infix declaration, maybe suddenly your code doesn't compile anymore because suddenly the precedence changed, leading to very awkward error messages that are just very weird to understand. And it's also quite difficult to implement, as I'll show now on the next slide in the last minutes, because I'll tell you why. And what the GHC compiler does, it actually has a grammar where it only has one precedence and later on it reorders the tree. Okay, so the same problem in a slightly easier disguise is happening in C. So in the standard C grammar, that is LR1, requires that an identifier that represents a variable is a different token than a type name, which is represented by the token type def name. So the grammar says, a declaration is a sequence of declaration specifiers and a declarator. The declarator is an identifier. And the declaration specifier could be a type name or a character. And then that whole thing makes up a declaration and has a semicolon at the end. Now, if we look at this declaration here, can anybody guess what the problem is? Remember, like whenever the parser sees the declaration of a type name, it will tell the scanner, here's a new type name. Next time you generate, you read in an identifier, make sure that you look up the right, give me the right token.
Yeah,
so I mean, so the scanner has a list of type names.
Yes.
It doesn't include point T at this point, but after this declaration has been parsed, so here it's empty, the set of type names. After this, the set will contain point T. Excellent. And what happens then? So what kind of token is this?
That's a declaration specifier.
Wait, tokens are... A terminal. So this is a terminal.
Yeah.
And this is a terminal. So what terminal is this? Is this an identifier or is this a type def name? Ah, so there's the net. So how does the scanner, how does the LR1 parser work internally? What does the one stand for? One look ahead token. So the thing is, the table is updated whenever this production here is reduced. Okay, this production is reduced when the scanner has delivered the semicolon. At that point, the table is updated, but the look-ahead token inside the scanner is already there. And that look-ahead token is actually an identifier because the scanner has created this lookup token immediately after it has generated the semicolon. And so the look-ahead token inside the scanner is already an identifier, and then the type table is updated, and then it's too late. Okay? So this whole production here is reduced, and at the point where it's reduced, the look-ahead token is already present in the parser, and the look-ahead token is an identifier. So then this point T will actually be an identifier and not a type def name. So this is actually quite a subtle problem in parsers like C parser. Is that clear how this worked? So the issue is that the parser internally has a one look-ahead token that it gets from the scanner before it reduces this whole production rule. And since that look-ahead token is already an identifier, by the time that this reduction rule is... by the time this reduction rule is reduced and the table is updated, that point T is now type name, this look-ahead token is already inside the parser. And so it is an identifier and not a type def name. Okay, so this is explained again. It's at least one look-ahead token. Yeah, and so it's already an identifier inside the scanner, the parser, sorry. Okay, so how can we fix this? Well, it's actually a bit difficult. Either you could try to change the look-ahead token, which is very messy. What you could do is you could just do away with the distinction between identifiers and type def names. So we could just like add a rule that the now non-terminal type name goes to identifier. And so everything is the same. The problem is the grammar that you get is no longer in LR1. So that's not a very easy, like then you have other problems. And you could try to register the type name earlier. And the way you can do that is you can try to separate out the special construction for the type def rule that somehow gets reduced before the semicolon is read. And if you can manage that, then once you reduce that type def rule, that special type def rule, so you say something like this whole declaration can go to blah, 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 type def declarator or this thing. And if you reduce the special rule, then by the time you read the semicolon, you hopefully have already updated the table. And the semicolon will be the look-ahead token and not the next identifier. So this is more or less just like saying, oh, this is not a good language design. Okay, so in the yeah?
Is this problem solved in the C++ grammar where it seems like in C++ you don't have to do type that, you can just use the names you declared for a class or a structure. Do they just use one identifier label?
I don't know. The thing is, C++ has so many other problems when it comes to parsing because they usually use an LL grammar, an LLK grammar because of these things, because it's not clear whether it's left shift or whether there's two templates that are being nested, things like that. Oh, but not always. But I thought all C++ compiler could handle this by weird hacks. No? Oh, okay.
Maybe now. In
C++ 11, we don't use fucking spaces. And in both C++ 11, most compilers actually have the
Okay. Well, at least this is always the canonical example why C++ is really difficult to parse, because LR doesn't really work there anymore. Okay, so I think we're done here. So basically in the today's seminar is about the attribute grammars, and next week's seminar could be about the symbol tables, implementing them in, for instance, C or C-like toy grammars. Okay, and next week we'll do type checking. Okay, thank you very much.